It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hundreds of millions of people can't be wrong, can they? The secret sauce of the tech deal of the day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 14th day of September. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, there is word today that a deal has been reached deciding the fate of the Chinese video sharing app TikTok. Early contenders Microsoft and Walmart are out. The U.S. database giant Oracle is apparently in. The deal is not exactly a sale. It's a partnership. But there is hope it's going to meet President Trump's requirement that China divest itself of that part of the company. However, there could be less to this deal than meets Oracle's eye, because China state media is reporting that one thing that won't come along with said partnership is the algorithm that makes TikTok so addictive and thus lucrative. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Jennifer Pak has the latest.
TikTok has been one of the most downloaded apps in the U.S. It's full of short and snappy videos that stream on a loop to users in over 150 countries. Videos like this cute clip of kindergarteners in China bouncing basketballs in sync. It was widely circulated on TikTok and its Chinese version, Douyin. Every time someone likes or swipes on a video like that one, the data is fed to the app's parent company, ByteDance. Its machines use the data to learn what users want to watch next, much like other social media apps. But ByteDance has been investing in this technology for years, and the result? An app that can tailor content for users within seconds. Shanghai user Ouyang Guangcai says she's hooked. She says she limits herself to only 30 minutes a day on TikTok's China version, Douyin. Otherwise, she'll keep watching health videos and never go to sleep. Her partner, Tui Tiansheng, tells me he gets neck cramps from watching Douyin clips on his cell phone. They are among the 400 million daily Douyin users in China and tens of millions of American TikTokers whose viewing data forms the base of the algorithm behind TikTok. And it's extremely valuable, says tech journalist Du Chen with the Chinese news site Ping West.
They use the data to improve the content recommendation, right? And that cultivates user loyalty.
And that user loyalty might be at stake if TikTok gets passed off to a U.S. company without the key to its algorithm. So even if Oracle gets to run TikTok's U.S. arm, the deal might not be a slam dunk after all. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This has been a Monday of deals, actually. Gilead, the pharmaceutical giant, is spending $21 billion to buy Immunomedics. They make cancer treatments. And Verizon, the country's biggest wireless provider, is paying $7 billion for TracFone, the country's biggest cell phone service reseller. That's phone industry speak for those monthly prepaid plans. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why a contract king like Verizon might want to expand into the contract-less phone business.
People who use a prepaid month-to-month phone plan are usually people who are living month-to-month. Angela Seifer directs the National Digital Inclusion Alliance.
Having a prepaid phone means that you control what the charges are and when the charges are.
Maybe your credit history means you don't qualify for a traditional contract plan, or you can't afford your plan 1 month, so you downgrade. With a TracFone prepaid plan, $15 a month gets you 500 minutes, 500 texts, and 500 megabytes of data. And you can top off your minutes at a retailer like Walmart or Best Buy.
It's a huge market. And in this recession, we can only assume that the market would increase.
When you see higher unemployment levels, when the economy takes a dip, there's often a shift more towards prepaid.
Brent Iadarola at Frost & Sullivan says prepaid phone plans make up almost 20% of the U.S. market. And Verizon is taking a bet this number will grow fast. faster than the time it would take to bolster its own prepaid service. Because why spend money on a makeover if you can just buy TracFone's 21 million customers?
It's kind of the fast track way to gain some significant share on the prepaid side.
And this deal isn't just a pandemic grab. It's a purposeful expansion. Ever since the market was boiled down to three major providers, Verizon, T-Mobile, and AT&T, these companies have had to become everything to everyone. Terry Kramer directs the Easton Technology Management Center at UCLA.
The carriers are having to look at other ways to grow.
The deal still needs approval from antitrust and telecom regulators, but Kramer says it'll probably go through. Because unlike the T-Mobile and Sprint merger that happened earlier this year, Verizon and TracFone can argue they're in complementary, not competing markets. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, some coronavirus optimism, that Oracle news, and it was off to the races again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a big hiring announcement from Amazon, one of the big winners in this pandemic economy as we do so much more shopping online. The company hired about 175,000 people earlier this year. Now it's looking for 100,000 more, and that's on top of about 30,000 new jobs. There are going to be some highly paid corporate technology jobs, remote for now, spread across the country. Quite the contrast, wouldn't you say, from the search for a second Amazon headquarters a couple of years ago, that whole HQ2 thing? From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
When Amazon announced its HQ2 search in late 2017, it was a battle royale between cities competing for tens of thousands of good-paying tech jobs.
Detroit is the starting line.
I love DFW.
There's never, ever been a more exciting time in Philadelphia than right now.
But slick videos and billions of dollars in incentives weren't enough to stop Amazon from choosing the rather predictable New York and Washington, D.C. areas, says Greg LeRoy at Good Jobs First.
You know, the biggest trophy hunt ever in U.S. economic development history. So it's fascinating to see this backflip now.
With the pandemic sending most tech workers home, Amazon and other large companies may finally be shifting their working model, says Professor Stephen Pedigo at UT Austin.
Rather than all of these workers being concentrated in, say, this new HQ2 facility in Washington, D.C. or in Seattle, maybe you're more open to these sort of remote hubs. And for many second-tier cities, that's probably a good thing.
He says it's easier for smaller cities to sell themselves to individual remote workers with affordable housing or charming downtowns than it is to meet the infrastructure demands for a big company headquarters. Richard Florida, an urban studies professor and author of The Creative Class, says tech companies still consider major hubs like Silicon Valley as key to innovation and growth.
I think that you're not going to see a big departure from the pattern of corporate headquarters location that we've seen, but you will see some adaptation and some tweaking at the margin.
Like more satellite offices outside city centers that allow workers to be closer to affordable housing, but within easy reach of the big cities, he says, are the engine of big ideas. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We're getting up close to 100 fires burning out here on the West Coast from the Canadian border all the way down to Mexico. You've seen the pictures, I'm sure, and you've heard about the air quality. Hazardous in a lot of places over this past weekend. That's literally the designation, hazardous. Turns out a lot of the firefighters doing the work on scene. Two-thirds of all firefighters nationally, in fact, are volunteers, people who hold down day jobs and answer the call when their local communities have a need. From KQED, Leslie McClurg has the story of a couple who've been fighting fires up in the San Francisco Bay Area.
An hour and a half northeast of San Francisco, multiple work crews sever blackened trees at Spanish Flat Mobile Home Villa. Brandon North steps through ash that was his home.
Somewhere over here in this concrete pad, there's footprints from my baby brother.
He picks up a warped piece of metal. A cloud of ash settles into the imprints of two tiny feet that have been there for 7 years. About a stone's throw away, Becca Brown Diener steps over a twisted birdcage on her family's property.
This was my twin brother's room, but now that's all gone.
This is what remains of their childhood homes, destroyed last month when wildfires struck California's wine country. As Becca surveys the rubble, her lower lip quivers. Brandon hugs her. They've been dating since high school.
We would always go over to his house, play board games, and our families are really close. So we did a lot of movie nights, camping trips.
Now the young couple lives together, 10 minutes up the road, where their campground hosts. About a month ago, they were asleep when a lightning storm exploded.
I'm terrified of lightning, so I was just kind of videotaping it, and I woke him up, and I was just recording it.
The radio started going crazy. We did have a couple small fires start.
Brandon and Becca are volunteer firefighters, but this was the first time Becca was sent to work a fire. By the afternoon, the small fires had turned into infernos.
Seeing fire for the first time like that, I was terrified.
Walls of flame 100 feet high swept over ridges. She was assigned to an engine. Brandon was sent to the front lines.
So I was excited because I like fighting fire. But then when it started to get into housing areas and stuff, the excitement went away and more of anger started to set in, I guess.
Especially the next night when flames swept into the mobile home park where he and Becca grew up. Brandon raced to their parents' neighborhood to help.
It was hard seeing this place burning down and just trying to do my job at the same time. When I came here, everything was fully engulfed.
As white, hot fire incinerated trailers, Brandon helped the few remaining residents to flee. They were people he'd known his whole life. After everyone escaped, including their parents, Brandon called Becca to tell her their family's homes were gone.
My heart broke. I just felt devastated and hopeless. I didn't know what really to do.
And then when I came in, she was sitting there crying, and I was holding her hand and kind of already on a knee. So I was like, well, it's in my pocket.
He's talking about the ring. He grabbed it to make sure it didn't burn.
She's a mess. She might make her feel better.
Finally, he asked me to marry him.
He wasn't planning on popping the question, nor have they had time to digest the big news with so many fires still burning. Becca says it may be time to flee the area. Brandon shakes his head. Not only is this home, but as a firefighter?
I guess a callous way of saying it, this is where the action is, so it's where I want to be.
If the fires relent soon, they hope to find time to celebrate their engagement. I'm Leslie McClurg in Napa County for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One thing we did this summer, my girlfriend and I, we actually got married.
Well, that is a big thing, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrials ended things up 327 points today, 1.1%, 27,993. The NASDAQ up 203 points, 1.8%, 11,056. The S&P 500 picked up 42 points, about 1.25%, finished at 33.83. Okay, so given the TikTok news, here is your historical analog. $580 million, that is what News Corp paid in the summer of 2005 to buy what was then the world's hottest social networking site, MySpace. Remember that? At the time, it was adding 70,000 users a day, had made stars of the Arctic Monkeys and Lily Allen. MySpace still exists, but when's the last time you checked your page? Meredith Corp, the current owner, gained 4.4% today. Facebook down 0.1%. Twitter down 0.4%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Delta Airlines, in a move that should surprise exactly nobody, said today it needs to borrow $6.5 billion. An airline executive said the other day the company is losing $27 million a day. The interesting slash surprising part of this deal is the asset that Delta's putting up as collateral, its frequent flyer program. Marketplace's Justin Hose is going to explain exactly how that's going to work.
Frequent flyer miles aren't only meant to build customer loyalty. They're also a product that airlines sell. Samuel Engel is senior vice president with the consulting firm ICF. He says the buyers are credit card companies.
And the credit card companies, in turn, give those miles to consumers as a reward for using their credit cards.
Engel says miles are a money-making machine for airlines.
At the beginning of this year, the programs of the four largest U.S. airlines together had been valued at $77 billion if they were standalone businesses.
Airlines can tap these programs to raise cash. One common method is to pre-sell miles to banks to get cash up front. Henry Hartevelt is president of Atmosphere Research Group. He says an airline can also spin off the entire program, as Air Canada did in 2005.
No airline, though, until recently, has leveraged its frequent flyer program as collateral against a loan.
Earlier this year, United put up its loyalty program as collateral for a government loan. Hartevelt says it's a creative way to raise cash.
At a time when air travel demand, especially by their more profitable business flyers, has fallen off the cliff.
Airlines have other creative ways to raise money. Scott Hamilton with the aviation consultancy Leeham Company says it's common for airlines to pledge their planes as collateral for loans, even their headquarters and airport gates.
But the frequent flyer program is, to me, the most creative and the most visible sign of the desperation that the airlines are in.
The risk for airlines, Hamilton says, is taking on too much debt. That can make it harder for them to recover from the current slump. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
It's not been a great couple of decades for the city of Detroit. Changes in the global car industry, both in manufacturing and what consumers want to buy, some depopulation and corruption in local government, and a couple of deep recessions have all taken their toll. One bright spot, though, has been that the number of women-owned businesses in the city more than doubled from 2012 through last year, at a time when the number of businesses owned by Black women have been growing across the country. Professor Courtney McClooney at Cornell has been studying Black women entrepreneurs in Detroit and how they are making it work there. Dr. McClooney, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me, why would you're studying Black female entrepreneurs in Detroit specifically?
Yes, a couple of reasons motivated us. One was that Black women have, over the last 3 or 4 years, been the largest number or the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs in the U.S. So there are more of them starting businesses at higher rates, despite having disproportionate access to resources including capital. And at the same time, a city like Detroit actually looks more like other cities across the world and in the U.S. And as much as people love to look at Silicon Valley as a model, it really is an unusual, unique, rare space. And when other places around the world have tried to replicate Silicon Valley's success, they're running into numerous issues that we are actually seeing in the city of Detroit. How can a place with very little resources, low population density, perhaps high rates of poverty, how is it that they are creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem? And I think that question lends itself to more possibilities for other places as opposed to a Silicon Valley model.
Yeah. You think Silicon Valley, right? And you think a white guy in a hoodie.
Yes.
You think Detroit, that's not necessarily. Yeah. You think Detroit, that's not necessarily what comes up. Tell me about the entrepreneurial infrastructure and ecosystem that you talk about there in Detroit.
Absolutely. So Detroit is known for many things. And one of the things in their past, it was really all about developing assembly lines, product management and development, and building out the middle class. Well, when you think about small business owners and entrepreneurships, that's also exactly what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the people in that ecosystem, they are very collaborative. They are also quite dedicated to the population that they're serving.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the ecosystem builders are addressing issues around poverty and education and workforce development. This is a really cool space to see how we can create an ecosystem that helps to develop and address some inequities that we see in society.
Yeah, so to that point about bringing Detroit back, let's talk about the city itself as a character in this narrative, because it is resource scarce. It has been through incredibly tough times the last generation or so. How does that influence the entrepreneur community in that city?
Yeah, Detroit has gone through numerous forms of economic, financial, political devastation. And that has meant two things. One, a lot of people saw it as an opportunity to actually create more innovative businesses. I think of Carla Walker Miller, who started an energy company when in the city, you know, those resources were being cut off and shut down because the city lacked the infrastructure at a time. There's also been an overwhelming response from people who are native Detroiters starting to come back. Melissa Butler, who founded the Lip Bar and whose products are sold in Target, and she opened up her first storefront in Detroit actually last year. She was in Detroit or in New York at the time. And one of the things about Silicon Valley, New York City, all these other larger markets is that you're competing at such a high level because there's so many people in the race. So we're seeing this increase in population density, especially of people who have gone away to get higher degrees, higher education, and come back and really start to rebuild the city.
You obviously spent some time in Detroit back when we all could travel. The stories that you heard, I mean, what were they, right? How hard was this for these women to do, and how do they stick it out, right? Because it's got to be tough.
Oh, my gosh, so tough. All of the Black women that I met in Detroit are amazingly resilient, and there was this really passionate desire to see the city not just come back and be reborn, but also to stay true to its roots and to be Detroit made. And there's just so much pride in that city, regardless of, you know, people going to high schools that were closed down and not having water for, you know, months at a time. But when you think about what makes a great entrepreneur, it's someone who has the ability to endure risk and to bounce back from hardships. And that is what people from Detroit have had to experience. So they really have all the gusto to be great entrepreneurs in that way.
Dr. Courtney McClooney is an assistant professor of organizational behavior. She's at the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Dr. McClooney, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
Come Wednesday, we're going to get the retail sales numbers for August, how much stuff we all bought last month. One way to tell how much stuff we are going to buy next month or the month after is by checking in with the people driving all of that stuff all over the country. Steve Fields is a trucker based in Kansas City, Missouri. He is also one of the 10 people we've been following for a series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. He sent us this update on the road-level view of the American economy.
It usually gets busier this time of year because of the holidays coming up. You know, you got Thanksgiving and stuff and Halloween, you know. So with that said, it should be a little bit busier, but it's definitely different. I remember last night I stopped at a place to get a cup of coffee and, you know, halfway into the building, oops, I forgot my mask. So you have to be thinking about it all the time, I think. So try to practice social distancing as much as possible and keep your hands washed and keep things wiped down. One thing we did this summer, my girlfriend and I, we went to Las Vegas for 5 days, and we actually got married. So my wife and I got a condo out there and spent about 5 days, got married. And Vegas was actually pretty neat because there wasn't as many people out there. So, I mean, you practice the social distancing, of course, and the mask, but we had a real good time, no issues. That was 3 weeks ago, so we're still in honeymoon phase, I guess. So. But we're back home, and we're both back to working.
All the best to Steve Fields and his new wife, Cheryl, there in Kansas City, Mo. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that the Federal Reserve begins a 2-day meeting tomorrow. There's not going to be any big news on interest rates. They will talk inflation a bit. That's a safe bet. They're going to run it a little bit hotter. The real news, though, about the Fed's meeting came from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin this morning on CNBC.
Well, let me just say, you know, I speak to Chair Powell almost every day, so I want to be careful in what I say about Fed actions. But now is not the time to worry about shrinking the deficit or shrinking the Fed balance sheet.
You have heard, I'm sure, on this program and elsewhere, Republicans starting to say the debt is getting too high the past couple of months and that the Federal Reserve is putting too much money into this economy. The Treasury Secretary, it seems, disagrees. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context with which to begin this week, since we had Justin on talking about commercial aviation's woes. This is an oldie, but a goodie. You guys know I love this. Yesterday, the Transportation Security Administration screened 809,000 passengers at this nation's airports. A year ago yesterday, 2.4 million. So we're still down 60-something percent. I don't know. I can't do the math in my head that fast. All right, we got to go. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.